is February 16th, 2019. It's the Family Day weekend, and rather than spend it with our families...
I completely forgot it was Family Day.
Not till Monday, technically.
I completely forgot it was a long weekend.
No work Monday. Perfect. We're sitting down together to talk municipal politics. This is the Canby Report.
I'm Patrick Meehan.
And I'm Ian Bushfield.
Unfortunately, Matthew can't make it today. I think he had a bit of a heavy workload yesterday and is down for the count today.
He and I were actually recording the pilot episode of an upcoming legal podcast that I'm sure he'll promote in the future and you can stay tuned for. But it involves some alcohol, so he is under the weather today. On today's show, we have tons to talk about. The SkyTrain to UBC is continually in the news. Corruption is continually in the news. Local rental is still unaffordable, and people differ over how to solve that issue.
So, to clarify, transportation, corruption, and real estate.
The usual.
So this podcast could be set in 1889.
We're going to also talk about a hospital, briefly.
So this podcast could also be set in 1889.
Things never change in Vancouver. As a quick reminder, though, make sure to subscribe to the podcast if you're not already. Find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I don't know if we've updated our Instagram recently.
I've done 100% of our Instagram posts, which is to say I've done all three of them, I think.
In the last couple weeks.
Yep. We're trying to expand a little bit more.
And most importantly, keep supporting us on Patreon at patreon.com/CanbyReport. And thanks to everyone in our Slack channel for keeping that.
Mm-hmm. Continues to be a really fun and informative piece of information.
Well, let's dive right in. As we mentioned, SkyTrain to UBC still in the news. The latest is the Mayor's Council has voted to pick SkyTrain as the best technology to go from Arbutus to UBC.
Yeah, the expansion of this is really falls on the heels of that City of Vancouver vote. And Kennedy Stewart said that basically he's going to go to the Mayor's Council and argue for SkyTrain. And if the City of Vancouver hadn't voted for it, I don't know what the vote would have been otherwise. But as we see, Kennedy Stewart seems to have managed to whip the vote pretty effectively at the Mayor's Council. Only two municipalities voted against SkyTrain to UBC, being Port Moody and White Rock.
They have a very strong voice there.
Well, it was a long conversation. And, you know, that non-weighted vote, too, was a big thing. Mayor Kennedy Stewart said that he wasn't going to weight the vote. And, you know, Mayor McCallum consistently had done a weighted vote, which means that you weight by population. In a weighted vote situation where Surrey and Vancouver are in agreement, all they need is one other municipality. And this non-weighted vote, I think, was a good sign of building bridges across the region.
I think it also highlights that Kennedy knew...
He'd done his numbers.
It was kind of a no-lose situation. He gets more press for it. And I think this, we were talking about this just before, is a factor that we kind of underplayed or discounted during the election, which is Kennedy's experience as a conciliatory politician, someone who can build bridges and work to make things happen.
I think we all watch Victoria and Victoria politics. And we see the confrontation, and we see that the lines are drawn, the trenches are dug, the, you know, machine gun emplacements are in place, and they're just dead set against each other. And so I think we really write off the ability to work around the aisles. And I say around, not across, because I don't think there is two sides in the region. And I think we all sort of play into that mantra of it's two sides, you know, you're not going to be able to convince anyone. People are either on side or they're not. And I really think that that's something that we need to get around our heads, that region-wide and even at the City of Vancouver is not the case.
Well, yeah, we look at all the different votes that are coming up at the City Council level, mm-hmm. and so many have been either unanimous or where there is a dissenting vote, it's almost a show, like the Gene Swanson, I won't vote for this, or the other is always Colleen Hardwick.
Or the 10-to-1 vote.
And this Mayor's Council thing where you get many municipalities, even the North Shore was somewhat edgy on this because they're like, should get more too.
Frankly, 5 or 10 years ago, there's no way the region would have supported it. There's a reason the region terminated at Arbutus, and that's because people didn't, you know, there was an attitude about, you know, privileged students getting a subway, Vancouver shouldn't get all the improvements and all of that. And you see some of that grumbling still. But, you know, for whatever reason, I think the conversation has really shifted. And part of that has to go to the feet of Kennedy Stewart for actually, you know, building a winning coalition.
And so we see he still missed two mayors, you know, Rob Vagramov in Port Moody and Daryl Walker in White Rock. I don't know anything about White Rock politics, so I couldn't tell you too much about Daryl. Rob Vagramov came up, I think, in some of my feeds. I don't fully claim to understand Port Moody politics, but it's a bit of a populist issue.
He really seemed to oppose it. I'm taking this mostly from Francis Beulah's Twitter feed, Fabula Vancouver. He really seemed to fight hard against a lot of the technology elements of it in ways that really clearly ignored the staff reporting. And it's not even that he called into question the staff reporting. I would question whether or not he read the staff reporting based on some of his comments that I've heard.
Well, and the staff reporting, to be clear, basically set out the different options from Arbutus to UBC, which is continued B-line, light rail.
LRT that would either terminate at Cambie and 41st.
Right.
Or Metrotown and 41st. Or what have you. Over that way in Burnaby somewhere. And so the idea would be that loop line and then that subway.
And in both cases, the staff, or in all the cases except SkyTrain, the staff said this will be overcrowded within 10 to 20 years.
Or day one, as the case with bus.
Yeah.
The bus flip around, the bus loop around from Arbutus to UBC would just continue to be as crowded as it is today. I mean, maybe you can run it at slightly lower frequencies, so and it's a lower distance, so it won't cost you as much as it does today. It's still an underbuilt, it's still too little.
And so SkyTrain becomes kind of the obvious choice then, especially when you remember that SkyTrain, you can easily add more cars and add greater frequency.
Yep.
So where there was still a cap on that, the staff noted, but yeah, you can also just double the capacity and you're fine forever. Maybe not ever.
Yeah. Well, and even we noticed, there's a couple of other things that came out of the TransLink report. For example, they're going to start doubling up the trains on the Evergreen Line and the Millennium Line. So instead of doing what now, to my mind, when I see them look small, is the single train going from, Vancouver to Coquitlam or Vancouver across the Millennium Line. They're going to double those up as they get more trains. And they're even starting to do that now as they've started delivery of new trains to expand capacity. They also announced, and this is stunning to my mind, that January 2019 had a 7% year-over-year increase in ridership over January 2018, which, and I don't have the numbers in front of me, but January 2018 had something like a 6% increase year-over-year with 2017, and 2017 had something like a 5% increase year-over-year with 2016.
And the population is not growing that fast.
Oh, certainly not. What you have is in a two-year run, from 2016 to 2018. So as of January 1, 2019, over 2 years, you had a 17% increase in ridership total. And then January is tacking another 7% increase on top of that, which compounding over the period means we could be looking at a three-year run of 25% increase in transit ridership. And that's pretty reasonable numbers. I don't know of a system in North America that's seen 25% increase in transit ridership in a three-year window.
I mean, it goes to the credit of Vancouver and the region's planning on this, and especially in the city of Vancouver, for a number of years, we've been talking about, can we get, what's their goal, 50% ride shares?
Well, they're past 50% now. Both New Westminster and Vancouver are the two municipalities in the region that I know of that are over 50%. Vancouver is, I think, at 55% walk, bike, bus commute.
Essentially not car.
Yeah, not car. And growing fast. And we'll see a transportation update in the city of Vancouver in May, June time, which should update some two-year-old data on mode share and mobility. And I'm anticipating significant changes. We know from 2 years ago that 10% of all commuter trips were done by bike. I'm guessing with the rise of Moto that that's gone up significantly. Or sorry, not Moby. Moby. Okay, we there are a limited number of puns and plays on words you can do when it comes to mobility, and unfortunately they're all used up now.
Yeah. But there were a couple other interesting aspects of this mayor's council in that it was more open than many have been in the past.
You've always been able to request to speak at mayor's council meetings, and I think it wasn't utilized for a couple of reasons. It wasn't advertised, and I think the mayor's council wasn't seen as being all that big of a body. Daryl Dela Cruz presented last year at the AGM to the mayor's council on SkyTrain versus LRT, and, credit to him, I don't agree with a lot of the research that he did. I think it was not the most thoroughly researched work, but his social media work and his campaign seems to have won. He did get SkyTrain for Surrey, and so there is that. So he did that. He made use of that, but not a lot of people have. I think Adrian Crook has made a presentation to TransLink in the past, but what we've seen now is basically anyone can show up at the start of the TransLink Mayor's Council meeting and talk for 3 minutes at the mayor's about whatever they want. So UBC showed up, a bunch of UBC people showed up to fight for the UBC subway because they knew it was on the agenda, and it's good to keep hammering that home. There was one speaker, Cam Fowler, speaking on behalf of the SFU gondola, which continues to be a valuable component to the conversation, mostly because a gondola would take, you know, 2 years to go from decision to opening, and the subway to UBC, subway to
Arbutus. And a gondola would work surprisingly well in the snowstorm we just had.
Actually, SFU closed about as much as every other municipality this time, just for whatever reason, I guess. But SFU does close for like 15 or 20 school days a year.
It was actually Burnaby School District's first closure in 26 years, I think.
Yeah.
Because I think my wife's a teacher there, and she was talking about the stories the other teachers had. And I guess a number of years ago, they closed almost prematurely.
I assume they closed in 96.
I think that might have been it.
The snowstorm of 96, where we got a half meter of snow overnight.
But I think there was a different snowstorm that was supposed to be really bad, and then they closed, but then they shouldn't have, and so parents were really
pissed. That's the Vancouver
story. And so the school district there just got really wary about ever closing schools, but it got really bad on Tuesday, and they called it.
Oh, yeah.
When everywhere called it.
Yeah. A lot of places called it. That gondola, I think, is still in the conversation and probably will find funding at some point as soon as they get another funding source. Maybe even as soon as, you know, we'll see Tuesday what the provincial budget has in store. Or, you know, when the federal election rolls around and they start throwing money at everywhere, they need to win. You know, the federal Liberals want Terry Beach's riding to be held, Burnaby North Seymour. It's entirely possible that we could see more money get thrown at infrastructure in the Lower Mainland for public transit. And then an anti-North Shore Beeline guy showed up and yelled about how it was thrust upon the West Vancouver, how West Vancouver, you know, this was brand new and they'd never heard about it despite it being on the books for like 10 years.
I mean, you have to pay attention to actually know about these things, and that's unreasonable.
It's impossible. You know, if you're a business owner, you shouldn't have to pay attention to what's changing with the transportation plans around your business.
I mean, West Van just shouldn't change, right? It should stay the wealthy enclave forever.
Look, it's a resort community. It's a beachfront community. It's a small village community. And that's the feel that they want.
So those are the people who came and speak. And hopefully we'll get more and more of that.
I like it. You know, I went to that West Vancouver Council meeting a couple weeks back, and they have the same rule at the end of the council meeting, 3 minutes to anyone that shows up to talk about anything they want. And, you know, I think 3 years ago I would have thought it was the dumbest thing in the world. But I actually think that it's a really cool way for people to get something off their chest, to feel like they've been heard, for council to have that engagement with that one person. Obviously you can't scale that up significantly well, but it's, you know, it's a fine, nice thing to do.
Yeah. The other thing that kept coming up, and I think from the mayor specifically, was this concern about possible contractors who might get picked to build the SkyTrain.
This has been a problem historically with transit. The Canada Line contracting bidding process between SNC-Lavalin, I said them already. We're supposed to save that for later.
Yeah.
between them and Bombardier was famously viewed as being rigged in favor of SNC-Lavalin. There was a lot of talk that the province was thumbing the scales and wanted SNC-Lavalin to win it for various reasons. SNC-Lavalin's been very tight with the BC Liberal Party historically. The former chairperson of SNC-Lavalin, as an example, was the lead on Christy Clark's
leadership campaign?
No, transition team to government. Was famously one of the leads. Was famously, I think, the chair of the transition. They've been deeply ensconced in BC Liberal politics for years. That has been an issue as well. You know, the Canada Line really only had two bidders, SNC-Lavalin and Bombardier.
I mean, it's just kind of a fact of Canada that we don't have many major engineering firms.
Yeah. And Bombardier got, you know, some what has been viewed as sweetheart deals to build a lot of things in on the SkyTrain line over the decades. So the mayors were very skittish, asking flat out how they could avoid SNC-Lavalin getting the contract, given the latest news at the federal scene, which you can, I believe, hear from on your podcast.
Yeah, on Politicos, we've talked about it for the last 2 weeks.
And probably next week and the week after.
We'll see how much more comes up. But it's just fascinating to me that mayors would be so openly, like, precluding a company, because it kind of feels
Well, and that's, you know, Matthew mentioned like that last week, too, was when Matthew and I were talking about Adrian Carr saying she's seasoned enough of a politician to know not to turn down money on the table. And he said, you know, it's great that people are, these politicians are willing to just say things as they are rather than in political speak. And it really is the case that mayors are not necessarily seasoned politicians. They're mayors, and some of them are small town mayors. You know, the mayor of... You know, what's a good example here? Port Moody, the mayor of Port Moody is mayor of like, the mayor of Port Moody, who, you know, was very critical of SkyTrain to UBC, he's mayor of 33,000 people. That's one third of a federal riding. You know, Jody Wilson-Raybo represents three times as many people as the mayor of Port Moody. And they don't have to be in that political realm of constantly torqued politics as you do elsewhere, which is also where that conversation we had earlier about compromise comes in.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just wondering if SNC will ever... I don't know the legality of them basically having in the minutes, we will
How
not...
How do we rig the system against this company?
I'm just waiting for the lawsuit to come up, but we don't have our resident lawyer on the podcast today.
Yeah, Ken Desmond did, to his credit, say that there are a number of other companies. He pointed out that none of the technology is proprietary. I think we often think of articulated light rail, which is the SkyTrain system, the linear induction motor. We often think of that as a Bombardier technology, and Bombardier makes a lot of it, but it's not proprietary. So, you know, Ken Desmond did say there's a lot of other companies they're talking to do work on these projects. And so it might be a healthy process where it's not a Quebec company against another Quebec company for the bidding process. We'll see.
Yeah. But that brings us into the other aspect we want to talk about, which is this growing mood around a corruption inquiry more domestically. So moving from Quebec corruption and whether that will bring that into Vancouver.
What, there's corruption in BC?
And we'll talk about domestic stuff.
Is there corruption in BC?
Well, people are apparently paying their property taxes in wads of cash.
Well, I mean, we've got an interview coming out soon with Melissa DeGeneva, who moved the motion to stop allowing cash payments for property taxes. It's about $13 million a year in cash, which sounds like a lot of money. It's a little under 1% of the money that the city collects in property taxes. I'm not sure how that $13 million manifests itself, whether somebody rolls in a
duffel bag.
but it's...
Do they pay in quarters? Is there that really, you know... bitter person who's like, I'm going to pay my property taxes in nickels because I got rid of pennies.
Like my friend Teal Phelps Bondaroff, who paid his tuition in the University of Calgary in coin and bills. Oh yeah, you're working with him, aren't you?
Yeah. Done a project with him.
But yeah, no, the city staff have not indicated it's a problem. There's not an indication. So Kennedy Stewart has ruled out calling for an internal Carbonneau-style inquiry in the city of Vancouver on the basis that there's not really evidence of money laundering. You know, while that $13 million in cash sounds like a lot, it doesn't seem to really set off red flags amongst people that are in the know. And so I'm not as worried about it.
But municipal councils are still talking about corruption in the real estate market and other aspects of the BC economy because their residents are. And yeah. So Brad West has been on Twitter about this for months, very active mayor of Port Coquitlam. And Vancouver City Council actually just passed a motion supporting a public inquiry at the province level to look at all of this. And the BC NDP hasn't ruled it out yet. But
I think they're slow walking to the point where they have to. I mean, I don't want to get into the provincial stuff because that's your bag with the Politicos, but it sure seems like we're going to get there.
I think because right now there are multiple inquiries on. There was Peter German's look at casinos last year, and now they're looking at, real estate, real estate, horse betting, and luxury cars. It's all so easily caricatured.
I thought you were going to say Vancouver.
Oh, yeah.
It's also Vancouver.
It's not my part, or it's not the Vancouver I live or inhabit.
Didn't you just leave the West Side?
Kitsilano for Metro Town?
Didn't you just move out of the West Side?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you have these municipal politicians kind of, I think, reflecting a feeling among voters and constituents that this is an intolerable situation and what can we do? And it's no real political capital for them to say,
let's look into it.
Do it.
Yep. Absolutely. We'll see where that goes. I think it's valuable, and it certainly seemed to get a lot of agreement.
Well, from corruption in real estate to just real estate in general, the topic of the last week Vancouver Poly Twitterata seems to be Is it time we just blow up Rental 100 and stop giving subsidies to people building market rate rentals?
Yeah, I highly recommend listening to this bit and then downloading Alex DeBoer's latest Seeking Office episode. In it, she goes through and she interviews one of the Vancouver Tenants Union people who's vitriolically opposed to the Rental 100 program, as well as Karen Sawatsky, who's a local rental housing advocate herself, who is former chair of the Rental Housing Task Force in Vancouver, is so both sides of the conversation about Rental 100 and what its pros and cons are. It's a very illuminating and insightful interview. I really, really appreciated Alex's work on that, particularly because I've wanted to do something like it for a long time and just never got the bandwidth and time to do it.
We're totally fine being scooped when people
absolutely.
Do it well.
I think especially if it's a good, yeah, if it's something good that adds to the community, the conversation, then we can talk about it.
Yeah.
So I think the biggest problem I have with Rental 100 is people don't know what its goal is.
So what is its goal?
Rental 100 is not a social housing tool. Rental 100 is not an affordable housing tool, although it uses the word affordable, which muddies the waters, and I wish it didn't. Rental 100's goal is to convince developers to, if they were going to build a condo, build a rental building instead. The condo would be out of reach of me. I wouldn't be able to buy it at all. But the rental, I would be able to rent. And that is the goal, is to transition some condo development into.
And so the problem, and so the program basically consists of just a waiver of some of the city's fees, the DCLs, the development cost levies?
Yeah, development cost levy, not to be confused with CAC. The CAC is if you're going for above zoning, which is an additional amount that the city will extract. The DCL is just a standard thing. There's two DCLs, utility DCL and a citywide DCL. The utility DCL goes towards, you know, sewer upgrades and roads and stuff like that, to a certain extent. And then the citywide DCL goes towards housing, transportation, parks, childcare, and utilities. And so what they do is they waive a good chunk of the DCL if you build a rental instead of a condo. The other thing they do is they allow a much higher SFR or square foot ratio, which is essentially the density. And so it's a good example, this 815 commercial development that everyone's talking about so much right now. What it does is it allows the developer to put in about 12 more units, depending on what configuration of unit they wanted to, if they built rental. So they get more units to rent, and they get a significant savings on the DCL, which is your development cost levy. And that convinces the developer that instead of building, say, 26,000 square feet of condo development on Commercial Drive, it builds 32,000 square feet of rental development, which is, I believe, the numbers involved in this.
And now for these to actually qualify, they have to make sure that the rents fit within a certain band, and yeah, you basically can't charge above.
So the city institutes a ceiling. The ceiling is, I believe, $1,700 for an east side rental development and $1,900 for a west side development. And that number goes up every year with inflation or what have you.
And it depends on number of units. You know, a studio can
That's for a one bedroom. Sorry. Yeah.
A studio is $1,600 for an east side versus like the highest rent is a three bedroom in the west side, which is $3,600.
Mm-hmm.
None of these, and we've seen speakers talk at council say, you know, if they're a student, I can't afford any of these. But some of the hope is expanding the market.
Yeah, well, and also a 1700, if the City of Vancouver is incorporating a ceiling of $1,700 for an east side one bedroom, what does a one bedroom rent for right now on Commercial Drive? It's not $1,700. It's more than that. So this is below, it's not a lot below market, but it is below market. There are some problems there with, for example, if somebody moves out, the rental manager can raise the rent to the rental maximum and so on. So there's some issues around that I think could be reformed. But broadly, what this does is instead of 26 condo units going in at, you know, 815 commercial, you have 33 or 35 rental units.
And so the other argument brought up, and the VTU advocate kind of comes back to this a couple times in her interview with Alex, is how much money is the city foregoing, and what else could they do with that? So let's make those numbers a little more concrete.
I was really curious. So I listened to the interview that Alex had, and I was really curious. So I got up this morning, and I pulled the city reports. I pulled as much information as I could. And because I'm not necessarily a city planner, I called up some city planner friends of mine to ask for clarification. They were very helpful with it. It really did give me a sense of it. There are two ways in which the waiver occurs. One is the citywide waiver, which, as I said, about a third of the citywide DCL goes towards other housing initiatives by the city or housing replacement. And that's an $80,000 waiver. So for the whole development at 815 Commercial, the 33 units or whatever it is. So the city is foregoing $80,000. They're also foregoing $60,000 in utilities DCL, which is essentially a direct subsidy to the thing, to the development. So the city will then take up the cost of the sewer uptake and stuff like that. There is still money collected in both of those. It's not 100% deferral or waiver, but it is substantial.
And so $100,000-$150,000 for this one unit.
Mm-hmm.
Or for this one development. For this one development.
It's be careful with unit.
Yeah. That, if you translate it to temporary modular homes, for example, gets you
so one temporary modular home, not a building, but one temporary modular home for one person, is about $110,000 to install and operate.
So it's a kind of trade-off for that.
Yeah, so the city foregoes development cost amounts that could build one temporary modular house or upgrade some nearby parks facilities a little tiny bit. In order to incent a developer to, instead of building 25 condo buildings, they build 33 or something like that, rental unit.
That's for the commercial unit. If we go across town, there's also a unit.
Yes.
There's also a development, sorry, on 4th Ave that's
because East and West radically changed the numbers.
Yeah.
So 4th Avenue at 4th and Maple, I think, is the Salvation Army building, which is going to be redeveloped into another 30-something unit rental building. They get, again, they get actually less square footage lift on this one based on the zoning. They get probably an additional 9 units using back-of-the-envelope math on how many square feet average unit size is to build rental. And they forego about $350,000 in development.
Which is a bit more sizable. I mean, it still only puts you in the realm of 3 temporary modular home units. And that's assuming we take all of that funds and put it in there and don't build any more park, don't upgrade the nearby parks, don't add any childcare spaces, which we know is a provincial priority.
Yeah, and so it's the dollars are really low. Like, if the Rental 100 program had not existed and they had instead taken all of the DCLs and plunked them all into temporary modular housing units, we might have squeezed out another 50 or 100 temporary modular housing units while also not getting, say, 3,000 units of rental housing.
So overall, it's still a program that I'm not a huge, like, this is the best program, but it's also, like, you know, I'm kind of just on the fence. And I think it's more of a matter of looking at it holistically. Like, this is one piece of a bigger puzzle.
Also, bear in mind, prior to the Rental 100 program, or the STIR program as it was originally developed into 100 program, the City of Vancouver, on average, in any given year, saw zero rental housing units being built, dedicated rental housing units. And now the City of Vancouver is seeing around 1,500 to 2,000 rental housing units being built a year. Let's call that a bit of a sizable shift. And frankly, as someone who is the target audience for the Rental 100 program, so I'm a little biased because, you know, I rent a one bedroom in the Olympic Village that we're in right now for the recording, and I rent it at a rate that is, you know, market rate. It's owned by somebody that owns it as a real estate speculation tool. You know, this is valuable for me. And 5 years ago, my partner and I were living in a basement suite that we vacated because we found a better new rental building that we're in now. And frankly, now that basement suite is being rented out to somebody else, and that freed that up. Now, you could say, let's allow the market to completely decide, build condos everywhere, and have individuals buy units and then rent them out. But we know from various studies that purpose-built rental is a far better experience and on average significantly lower price for the renter than this sort of like haphazard system of, I live in a building where probably a third to half of the units are being rented out by speculators.
I think that answer for me is just we need more. Like, oh, yeah. This is one tool, but let's see more efforts. Vancouver Tenants Union
is absolutely right. We need to build social housing. We need to build true affordable housing. But Rental 100 program's goal is not that. The Rental 100 program's goal is supply. It's to build more rental so that we can have more rental for people to move into. So let's add more programs to build rent, to build actual social housing while also encouraging condo developers to switch to rental.
I'm on board.
Yeah, and definitely do tune into Seeking Office to take a look at that interview, especially now that we've sort of had that conversation about what, because I think that's one of the problems is that we don't know those numbers, and I'm glad that we dug into them because there's this feeling that Rental 100 program is a giant sop to developers, when in reality, it's a small amount of money.
Yeah. Well, we mentioned the proposal at First and Clark, and that one is looking like it's the next contentious development that City Council will have to make a decision on. Do we have any early indications of where that's going to go?
So First and Clark has been very controversial. That's the development we talked about last week on the podcast. That is a detox facility as well as social housing units, and it's a full spectrum of support for people coming transitioning out of poverty.
Important project.
Yeah, I'm wildly in favor of it. So the City of Vancouver has received 56 pieces of correspondence about the project. Ian, what would you think the ratio would be? I mean, you know the answer, but what would you have thought?
Generally, you always think people only write when they're angry, so strongly opposed.
So I haven't looked at the actual responses, which you can actually look at. I like that the City of Vancouver posts them. They blank out the names of who sent it in, but they give and where they live and whatnot. But you can see the responses. And they, 46 in favor of the project and 9 opposed. Now, oftentimes a flurry of opposition will come forward as we get closer to the hearing. So if you oppose the project, write into City Council. You can find it at City Council's website. But it is neat to see that people are in support of it.
And I think that almost goes back to all of the changing dynamics we've seen in Vancouver, right? The organizing of the abundant housing types and of other groups, whether they're that, but just this pro-housing vibe. And even, is VTU in favor of this? Or do they even have a position on it?
I don't know. I haven't seen their positions. I know the Grandview Woodland Community Association, or whatever the hell it's called, which has stood opposed to any kind of a density build in Grandview Woodland, which is roughly where this is. I have difficulty considering this part of Grandview Woodland, but it is. They're fairly opposed to it because they're inconsistent with their name. But it's going to be interesting to see where the opposition comes out of, because it is really hard, I think, on a moral standpoint to argue against this kind of a project.
Well, hopefully City Council decides on that way, and I'm hopeful it goes forward.
If you are interested in speaking, the public hearing is on February 20th at 6 p.m. at City Council. You can go onto Vancouver Council website and sign up to speak. The email address is there. You can also you can also just simply email in a correspondence. And frankly, and I've had this conversation with a lot of people, and I'm going to keep saying that every chance I get, is every time I talk to people and I say write in, they say, I don't have time to write in all of my reasons why I support or oppose a thing. And at the end of the day, the city councilors just want to get a temperature take. And I personally, if I write in, I would want to write in a 3-page memo outlining the pros and cons and why the pros outweigh the cons, because I'm a policy researcher by trade. But in reality, City of Vancouver have staff for that, and they're much better than I am at this. And so if I just simply write in, I like it because it does this, period, send. City Council gets, and that volume is what matters more than the actual what you say. But above the volume is that personal story. You know, I live near there and I support it because.
Yeah, those, personally written, unique letters, I think are always valuable. But if you are really struggling for time, like I mentioned, people are more organized today than they were 5 years ago. And whether you're in favor or opposed, going to bet you can find a form letter that you can just either copy and send or hit a button to send.
Yep.
And yeah, there's nothing totally wrong with
that. And there's a lot of organizations that do form letters now. Yeah. Abundant Housing has been doing a good job with their form letters. They get quite a volume of it. The Grandview Woodland Community I can always get their name wrong, but they oppose a lot of these projects. They do something similar. I think Gene Swanson's team have done these form letters as well, where you can just go to their website and it's got a form letter. You can edit it if you want and just hit send.
Well, and finally, moving a little bit up Main Street, not too far away from there, the new site for the St. Paul's Hospital is officially going ahead. The BC government announced, was this yesterday? The BC government announced yesterday.
Realistically speaking, 2 years ago. But these announcements get announced and then re-announced and then re-announced.
Well, they basically...
It's final now, I guess.
Yeah. Said we have the money for it now. Yeah. This is $1.9 billion to rebuild St. Paul's Hospital at Main and Terminal, moving it from the West End on Burrard Street and that big red old iconic building that is probably like most old buildings in this province, structurally unsound and going to collapse in an earthquake, which is not good for a hospital.
I mean, well, it is also red, like red brick, 1800-something build.
And so the goal now is to have this built by 2026.
Ambitious.
Which is ambitious. Yeah. It and the Arbutus SkyTrain line will be open on the same day, I bet. Probably not in 2026.
Probably not.
This generates a lot of mixed feelings.
Yep.
Because people really like the idea of a hospital on the downtown peninsula.
Well, I respect that. The hospital is at the brimming at the seams. My understanding is some components of St. Paul's will be maintained. I think it's possible the emergency room is in talks to be maintained. Some element of that there. It is a heritage building, so it's unlikely that they're going to do much with it other than keep it. And so there's that component, but like we have a limited amount of hospital facilities in Lower Mainland. VGH can't expand all that much more than it already has. RCH, Royal Columbia Hospital, can't expand that much more given its footprint. Surrey Memorial has a lot more room to grow, but that's serving a different region, like actually.
Yeah.
And then, you know, there's not a lot of other Burnaby Hospital is limited in size, although they're going to have to rebuild that soon. It's getting quite old. This is a huge expansion of hospital and care facilities in the Lower Mainland. And I'm just looking at the demographic trends. I think we're going to need it.
Well, and it represents a big sort of change to a neighborhood of Vancouver. When you put an employment center like that, a destination, like you look at the traffic along Broadway, and one of the reasons it's so busy in that
hospital Canby district to is huge.
Granville,
yep,
is the hospital district, and with the I think that's pretty close also to the Northeast False Creek redevelopment, and so
well, it is we in will. The False Creek Northeast False Creek plan.
There we go.
It is within that sort of envelope space, and so it should get its own SkyTrain station, more or less. There's a whole host of things. There has been talk, and I doubt this, but there has been talk about plunking another Expo Line station down between
Commercial and Main.
Commercial and Main, which would be on that flats area, like right by First and Clark.
That is a pretty long stretch of traffic.
It's a very long stretch, and so right there at Terminal and where Home Depot is, for lack of a better descriptor, there's been talk of that, and so this whole build out is going to be a substantial expansion of parcel space. City of Vancouver, I think there is interest amongst council to expand the amount of residential space in that parcel. It was criticized by a lot of the housing supply advocates for not having enough density infill. It's got a fairly low overall density. City, but it's a large area, so it's a reasonably high number of units. So there's a lot of talk there for this being a big parcel of land.
It'll be interesting to watch that neighborhood change yet again as downtown Vancouver has expanded in different ways, and it basically builds downtown out into
downtown
park almost.
Downtown is pushing at its seams, and we talk about how Metro Vancouver is bordered by water, mountains, a border, and then just keep going east.
Yeah.
Downtown Vancouver is bordered by water, a giant park, water, and
an empty lot.
East.
Yeah.
Well, and that's it's also Railtown. Being now called, what used to be and is now called again Railtown, and other people would just call it the downtown east side. It's pushing in there as well, which is causing displacement and a lot of problems. Downtown Vancouver is pushing at the seams, and it's going to keep expanding. And that's this Northeast False Creek is a component of that.
Well, I think this discussion about the changing nature of Vancouver brings us perfectly into our Vancouverada for this week.
Mm-hmm. So 90 years ago this year, on January 1st, the city of Vancouver nearly increased its population by over 50% in a day.
This is the day that Point Grey and South Vancouver amalgamated with the city.
And we've talked about this before, and I think it's always fun to talk about it again because we always add another thing here or there that we've picked up.
Yeah, so in 1908, South Vancouver was incorporated, and that basically consisted of what is this, south of 16th?
Yeah, that 12th to 16th area was a bit of a gray zone, but yeah, 16th essentially.
And what I found fascinating, and I'm flipping through your Historical Atlas of Vancouver and the Fraser Valley by Derek Hayes.
Really good pickup, by the way.
Is they talk about the schism that led to the creation of the Point Grey town site or municipality, which essentially happened after a bunch of poor people moved into South Vancouver and the wealthier side went, well, we don't want to live next to the poors. And if you go back to one of our early Vancouver autos, we talked about amalgam or what's the opposite of amalgamation? Secessions, I guess.
Seceding, yes.
Of why are there two Langleys? Why are there two North Vans? And this was essentially why there were three Vancouvers. You had Vancouver proper, you had South Vancouver, and then you had rich Vancouver in the Point Grey town.
And so on January 2nd, I think it was the first meeting of the new council, which was Mayor Malkin, who you might know from going to concerts in Stanley Park. Mayor Malkin oversaw a council of 12 aldermen. I guess back then we had aldermen and not councillors. And back then we had 12 of them.
And they also represented wards.
They represented wards. Wards were eliminated in the 30s, so not too much longer after that. The wards represented, and they were straight-line wards. They weren't broken up by neighborhood, which confused some people. And I'm getting most of this out of the Chuck Davis History of Metropolitan Vancouver work, which is also a really good giant coffee table book. The wards themselves were, as I said, straight-line wards. There were 12 of them, and I find that really fascinating because we only have 10 wards today, and yet at that time... We only have 10 counselors then, and they had 12 and a mayor, and also 250,000 people back then, as opposed to our...
700,000?
700-ish thousand people.
We're just more efficient at representing people now.
You know, you can cut down the number of people you represent if you just represent the whole of the city.
Yeah. I like the idea of drawing wards randomly. It feels like an engineer or someone went to the map and went, well, we'll do it evenly and just like draw lines.
Just draw lines.
Yeah.
Grab a ruler.
Don't talk to anyone.
Don't talk to anyone. Don't look at where neighborhoods are.
You know, it's not gerrymandered then.
No, actually, it's certainly not. It's just also not necessarily good either. No. What's the opposite of gerrymandering?
Arbitrarily drawn?
Yes. And then the amalgamation carried forward. That, again, I think we've mentioned in the podcast, that's also why City Hall is where it is, because it's on the boundary between the three municipalities, because that's how you compromise, I guess.
It does, in the long run, end up being a nice new neighborhood for Vancouver.
Well, that was, I think, our show for the day. We do have a couple of interviews coming up with Councillor Weave and Councillor DeGeneva that as soon as we get around to editing them, we'll get put out as well. That should be probably later on this.
And we should have a special feature recording that was passed along to us from the city's planning commission of a recent conference that they had.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That should be really fun to listen to.
And so we'll take a listen to that and try and get it out for you so that you can learn a bit more about what is talked about at that level. As always, remember to find us on Patreon, patreon.com/CanbyReport.
And the Patreon, as we say, always gets you access to our Slack channel, which is always informative, interesting, filled with some insight, and a good swath of people from a bunch of different areas. It's a fun conversation.
And we have a phone number that I don't have in front of me, but I'll post it in the show notes if you ever want to leave us a message for a future episode. Or you can just email us at canbyreport@gmail.com. For the Canby Report, I'm Ian Bushfield.
And I'm Patrick Meehan.
Thanks for listening.